an Enterprise Time Security Podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. My guest today is Charles van der Velt, who's the Global Head of Security Research at Orange Cyber Defense. Charles, good morning.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me on the show.
Do you want to tell us a bit about yourself?
Yes, of course. So I'm a South African, as you can probably tell from my accent, talking to you this morning from Cape Town, born and bred. And I came to the group because a firm that I'd helped found here in South Africa got acquired by Orange Cyber Defense. We were an attack and penetration testing team. That team is now part of the Orange Cyber Defense family and leads their attack and penetration testing capabilities. But I was moved out into this new role, and you and I were just joking about this slightly obscure title. So the global in my title refers to the fact that I'm not attached to a country. I report into the headquarters in Paris, and we serve the entire company. Our job is to maintain situational awareness of what's happening in the security landscape, what's happening in the threat landscape, how that might impact us and our clients, and then communicate that to the people inside and outside the business that benefit from knowing what's going on.
We spoke before Christmas, and one of the things we spoke about before Christmas was looking at cyber extortion, which has become quite popular. But instead of looking at it from a pure cybersecurity perspective, looking at it through the lens of crime theory. So what does that actually mean, crime theory?
You know, it's so interesting. It's like so many things where you've spent your whole life immersed in one domain, in one vertical, and you make the effort to examine another domain or vertical, and you discover that it's got the same depth and breadth and history and nuance as everything you know about your space. We were interested in the problem of ransomware or cyber extortion and convinced that it wasn't a technology problem and wasn't going to be addressed by technology. We started thinking about what other domains might speak to this problem, might inform us about the problem. It struck us as obvious that it's a crime and that people have been studying crime for a long time. To answer your question, that's what criminology is. It's the formal study of the causes, the methods, and the impacts of crime. We felt it would be useful to examine whether some of these formal theories of crime could be applied to cybercrime, because that's, as it happens, not a given. And if one did do that, what might emerge from an examination from that perspective? And concretely, how might we think differently about how we go about countering the ransomware problem?
What intrigued me about our previous conversation was when I look at what we do, we don't treat this in the same way as the police would treat a crime. And part of that is because we've got this broken mechanism between what were physical crimes that the police and the criminal justice system understand, and they understand how to prosecute, how to research, how to investigate, and cybercrime, which has always been a little bit woolly and very complicated for police to understand because there's nothing they can physically see. There's no physical goods taken when somebody steals something. There's no broken window. So how do you begin to apply those concepts of criminology to cybercrime?
That's an excellent question. It was the first barrier or obstacle that we encountered in trying to do this work. And it's by no means resolved, incidentally, within the criminological fraternity. They talk about, they've even got names for the camps of academics who believe that crime theory can be applied to cybercrime versus those who believe that it can't. As you say, there's very real reasons for that. Generally speaking, crime has to occur in a place. That's how jurisdiction is determined. Cybercrime, where's the place? And what was stolen? And where's the evidence of forced entry, et cetera, et cetera. The first thing we did, which we found useful, is we made the point that when you talk about ransomware, and you very kindly introduced this topic as cyber extortion, because what we uncovered is that when we generally speak about ransomware, firstly, everyone is using that term to describe different elements of the problem, but they're also reducing it to one thing. The argument we make in our paper is that cyber extortion, which is the term we prefer to describe the crime, is actually the convergence of a number of different crimes. If you break it down into the different crimes, then I think you can find analogies to real-world crimes that are described in law and are well understood by police. It's not that there aren't still challenges, but the first thing we had to do is to say, well, firstly, we can't refer to this as ransomware because ransomware is a tool. You can't criminalize a tool. That doesn't make sense. The crime is fundamentally extortion. And the crime of extortion is the culmination of a number of other crimes that have to happen either before or in parallel with the extortion in order for that final act to take place.
How much of the complication in understanding it is driven by the industry? We're an industry that delivers tools. And when we look at ransomware as the end of a chain of different attacks, the problem is what tools have failed in order to get to that point for the attackers to have got through. In addition, ransomware is rarely a one person starts it and that same person finishes it type of crime. There are multiple actors here who do part of the crime and then sell on their successful bit to third parties. You don't get that with breaking an entry. You don't get somebody who comes along and picks the lock and then says to the next person, hey, I've picked these six locks. Do you want to go and burgle these premises?
Go and grab the TV.
How do we make that something that, first of all, people can get their heads around? And how does the industry begin to get its head around that?
I'm hearing two parts to your question, Ian. The first is the comment that this crime, because of its organizational structures and complexity, is different to other crimes. I don't think that's actually true. I think organized crime is very well understood in the real world. And the structures that we observe amongst these cyber extortionists are familiar. I don't think they would be mysterious to the police. I think they get that. So in that sense, I don't think that part is such a great mystery. In fact, there's language and research within criminology that explains very nicely how, for example, crime scales because of these complex structures. They've got names for it that I can't remember now, but these are concepts that are well understood and researched and described within academia. Then on the industry side, I think in fairness, the industry understands the problem very well. It's very hard to make a comment or deliver a paper or add anything to the conversation that hasn't already been identified and understood by somebody else. What we're poor at is communicating that in a sensible way. For example, we're an industry that's fundamentally incentivized to sell things and make profit, not fundamentally incentivized to address the crime. And I make no apologies for that. I think that's fair and reasonable. But we also have to be honest about it and honest about the challenges that that presents us with. One of them is, for example, that we hang on to this term, ransomware, fully understanding that it's ambiguous and amorphous and doesn't really say anything. But we hang on to it because it has good SEO, and that's the term that everybody uses. You can speak until you're blue in the face about cyber extortion and no one will listen to you because they don't know what it is and they don't care. And that leads to a lack of precision in our analysis, but also a lack of perhaps honesty and integrity in how we describe our solutions. Any vendor will tell you right up front because they know that their solution is not going to fundamentally prevent an attack from happening. And again, I don't think they have to apologize for that. I think that's well understood. But it's very difficult for those vendors to make the assertion, for example, that you shouldn't be putting more technology in. They won't make that jump. And even us, if I'm honest, when we talk, it's a difficult thing to say. Clearly, we want to make the argument there's a space for technology, and there is. But those two parallel challenges, the challenge of precision and the challenge of integrity, make it very difficult to have informed conversation with people outside of the industry, like policymakers and law enforcement and the average person, because we mix it up a lot.
When we spoke previously, you broke down the attack chain on ransomware and compared that to ordinary crimes, and then the methods we would use in an ordinary crime environment to look at reducing the opportunity for the attack or understanding more about the attackers. When we apply that to our current state, the challenge we have is that the support teams, the SOC teams who are running in to deal with this, are not trained in criminology. They're not trained in traditional methods of doing an investigation. What can we provide them with that enables them to understand better where the risk comes from, how the risk occurs, why the customer's more at risk, what the motivation is for the attacker, and why the motivation for the attacker, and apply that to resolving the problem?
Ian, that's a challenging question. And maybe just to clarify something, I don't think that your SOC team, the team manning the video cameras, necessarily need to understand the criminological view of this problem to do their jobs. Their job is generally to do with detecting indicators that an attacker of some kind is busy in the environment. In truth, most of those technical guards won't be able to deduce the motive for the activity they're seeing until much later, if at all. You mentioned kill chain because that's an important factor. Because how this crime is organized, the actual compromise of an environment, you can generally expect is going to be divorced from the ultimate impact of the compromise. There are exceptions, nation state or state-backed actors going after intellectual property or trade secrets, whatever. They're going somewhere for a reason and they've got something in mind. But I'm strongly of the opinion that most of crime starts with somebody opportunistically finding something they can compromise, evolving that compromise through its various phases until they have a comfortable level of control without risking being detected, then determining what they're going to do with that compromise. When we detect and respond to these players, it's often in the middle of that process. There's no way of knowing from the indicator that you've seen and perhaps responded to where they're ultimately going to go.
One of the reasons I called out the SOC team is that a lot of the conversations I've been having over the last 6 months around computer forensics, it seems to be that the SOC team are being increasingly drawn into that attack forensic or post-attack forensic environment. They are seen as the experts in understanding the attack, and therefore there's an assumption that they bring an awful lot more information to the forensic team, which seems to be a significant shift from maybe 5 years ago, where the two roles were absolutely divorced, and the forensic team were more worried about what damage the SOC team would do while they were quickly repairing and getting the client up and running, and were losing data. There does seem to be a merging or a morphing of roles here.
I think that's true, and I think perhaps one of the drivers for that is that your response to a compromise does perhaps increasingly require you to think on behalf of the attacker. For example, how deeply are we compromised? Are we dealing with a few machines or just one? Do they have access to our backups? Are they likely to follow through on a threat to DDoS us? All of those things will play into what very often the core part of the strategy is, which is in the negotiation with the criminal in the case of extortion. So I can see that the issue of forensics, the issue of response, the issue of recovery all become intertwined in that moment and collectively have to provide decision makers with guidance as to what their response should be at any given time.
One of the terms you used previously was capable guardians. What does that mean?
It's a key point in our hypothesis. So just zooming back for a moment to the question of criminology, there are multiple ways of thinking about crime, how it happens, what encourages it, etc. One of the theories that tries to describe the factors that contribute to crime is called routine activity theory. And it was described back in the 70s by two very famous criminologists, but it's persisted because it obviously has some grounding in reality, but it also works very well as a theory to work from. It makes the argument that crime is more likely to occur when three separate factors or sets of factors converge. The first is what they call a motivated offender, someone who's willing and able to do the crime. The second is what they call a suitable victim, somebody who presents themselves as vulnerable in a place or at a time to be targeted by this criminal. Then they describe the lack of a guardian. The guardian is an external factor or an external person that can intervene between the offender and the victim. In traditional policing, we would tend to think about that as the police. You know, it's the police's job to spot these people and stop them. But actually, Cohen and Felsen, the gentleman who devised this theory, make the argument that because of various constraints, primarily that the police cannot be everywhere all the time, suitable guardians more often take the form of social structures, either informal or formal. Formally, that could be something like a neighborhood watch or a community watch. Informally, it could just be line passers-by, curious neighbors, people who just have each other's backs. And where a suitable guardian then presents themselves between the offender and the victim, they argue, and I think it's subsequently been proven, the criminal is much less likely to perform the criminal act. One of the types of guardians is what they would call technical controls. back in the 70s, that would have been very simple things like locks on doors, gates and burglar bars and stuff like that. Or maybe slightly more advanced things like CCTV cameras. Those things are understood to act as a deterrent and reduce the likelihood that crime occurs. One of the challenges that one faces when trying to transcribe these real-world theories to cyberspace, and one of the reasons I think we keep falling short, is that we tend to focus on primarily these technical controls. We make the argument that burglar bar is like a firewall and a lock is like a password and a CCTV camera is like your monitoring solution. Therefore, we need capable guardians in the form of these technology controls, which has real issues because just like the police, these controls cannot be placed everywhere. Even when they do, the place where the crime occurs is technology. By introducing more technology in the form of controls, we perversely also extend the attack surface and create more spaces where crime can occur and more spaces where you need technical controls. Based on this theory, the implementation of technical controls to address the issue of crime in cyberspace is almost doomed to failure from the start. Similarly, the problem of putting police everywhere where a cybercrime could occur is also doomed to fail from the start. That leads us then to either focus on the victim or the offender, or to look at the form of guardianship that Cohen and Felsen preferred and advocated for, which is community-driven guardianship, which is another very interesting topic one could explore.
Now, that community-driven guardianship is one of the reasons that I really enjoyed our past conversation. When I look at where we are at the moment, you could argue that the police have become internal cybersecurity teams or SOC teams. They've become almost private security teams rather than a community-owned team. But you mentioned the concept of neighbourhood in our previous conversation. And we do see interaction between SOC teams from different vendors and different MSSPs, but we don't really see that wider neighbourhood watch that you would perhaps have in a community. How do we set aside some of the commercial concerns about that interaction for the good of protecting technology, or does commerce end up winning out?
That's, again, a very good question, Ian, and something that interests me deeply. I feel that if we hope to get some real tangible benefit from guardianship, whether in the form of technology or through structures and communities, the starting point, and this is something that routine activity theory points us to, is that we have to upend the leadership structures around the security problem. And in my view, so far, the discussion of the security problem, the description of the problem, and the discussion around the solutions that are likely to address the problem have emerged up until recently from the vendor space. You know, the vendors describe a problem and then describe a solution to address that problem. I don't think there's malintent there. I think there's a lot of goodwill there. But both because of the problem of incentive, but also because of tunnel vision view on the technical solutions and the services that vendors sell, I don't think we're getting the holistic view from the vendor community that we should get. And increasingly, we're now turning to governments and expecting governments to intervene and taking leadership from governments. There's definitely a place for that. But again, I don't think the national government is the place where almost localized crime needs to be addressed. If you then look at established real-world community policing initiatives, the one model that emerges is the neighborhood watch. The primary thing it does, and the thing that I get excited about, is it upends that dynamic. So it starts with an affected community saying, we are going to play the role of the guardian on behalf of ourselves and our community. We are going to do that in partnership with vendors, professional service providers, and law enforcement. But the description of the problem, the vision for the society that we want to live in, the balance between freedom and risk, for example, that's going to be for us to determine. And we will then define that problem and our goals to our providers and to law enforcement and use them as and when that's necessary. Now, that's a hard thing to realize in cyberspace, but I think people are starting to think like that more and more. That's where the dynamic will start to shift.
The challenge that I see is how do we get a proper neighborhood approach to this? It's very easy to see security researchers who come in as providing part of that neighborhood approach, and they do an incredibly good job. They identify things. They put out a lot of information and intelligence for us. But actually, they do it on a broad stroke. They don't do it for particular communities that would understand it necessarily. And that brings us to the challenge of intelligence. We are drowning in intelligence in this industry. The problem is that intelligence is very raw and gets interpreted by everybody differently. We've seen that with police forces. Police forces are now starting to share intelligence, but actually they're sharing how they've interpreted that intelligence. How do we get better intelligence sharing with the industry that's not a case of, look, here's 10 million alerts that we found? Because 10 million alerts is pointless. What I want to know is, here are 3 alerts that impact me, and here's what I've got to do to fix those alerts. And we're not really doing enough around actionable intelligence and sharing of why that's actionable. What needs to change?
Ian, you're putting your finger on very important but tricky issues. The topic or the manifestation of intelligence is something that the security industry adopted from other domains like military, law enforcement, business intelligence, and they try to co-opt into our space, often as a commercial thing. The form that it's taken is not necessarily the form that the community needed, but rather the form that could be packaged and sold, distributed, etc. And that's not necessarily bad. There is a lot of value in, for example, cyber threat intelligence. But I think it is largely misunderstood and promoted perhaps beyond its direct use cases. The question of how you would address that is, go back to my previous answer, by starting with a set of requirements that are defined by the community rather than a set of requirements that are defined by the industry. That dynamic is starting to become visible, for example, industry-based collaboration forums, where previously perhaps banks or insurance companies would see each other as competitors and want to stay secret. And now increasingly, you're seeing them forming certs and talking much more openly about what kinds of attacks they're seeing, what form those attacks are taking, how they've responded to it, who the criminals are, etc. That starts to get closer to the vision that you described and can then be facilitated by vendors who can offer platforms or feed data into things like that. But I really think it starts with identifying who a community is. Who do we want to share information with? And not letting commercial power be the barrier to that.
But one of the challenges of communities coming together, such as insurance and finance, is they are regulated industries. And the information that they are allowed to share is controlled by a regulator who, with the best will in the world, has generally little clue about this particular subject in hand. So how do we balance out the needs to regulate an industry for the good of society and for the good of competition with the needs to protect that industry?
Honestly, Ian, that isn't something that I've thought about a lot, and I don't have much experience with how that regulation impacts the need to share. But I am aware that there are technologies and approaches that allow for the sharing of, for example, threat intelligence without compromising anyone's confidentiality or right to privacy. And I feel like technically those problems can be solved and are increasingly being solved. But where I think the gap is, and sorry to twist your question back at you, but where I think the gap is that I think that definition of community needs to be examined and maybe revisited, because it is sensible at one level to say, well, as an insurance company, I expect to see the same kinds of threats as my competitor. And so you'd compete and collaborate at the same time. We'll collaborate to the extent that it doesn't affect our competitive advantage. But I'm not sure that that's actually the community that we need to be thinking about. Maybe the community we need to be thinking about has more to do with our supply chain, with our vendors, with our customers who live together with us in this sort of interdependent state where impacts to our security affect them and impacts to their security affect us. The idea of communities having to be aligned along verticals, this place for it. But I'm not sure that that's a complete definition of what community means or where all of our efforts should be invested.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because when I look at finance, I see a lot of sharing around things like fraud. They all know they suffer from fraud, and in fact, they've built mechanisms now to share information around fraud. But that was built out of traditional policing and traditional challenges they faced. They've now adopted that around their technology solutions and their technology practices. But when you talk about industry verticals, that becomes much more complicated to me, because the idea of an industry vertical is much more of a business theory construct than a crime construct. A policeman doesn't walk into a company that's been burgled and says, oh, well, of course, in your line of work, Squire, you should expect that because we find that 95% of dentists get burgled on a Monday morning. So how do we widen that? How do we get people almost in a chambers of commerce type mentality to see that as a wider engagement?
That realization is almost being forced on us now, isn't it? Just by virtue of the security debt that we've accumulated over the years and the costs that that's enforced on us. The point is that you cannot ensure or assure your security in isolation. It's not a problem you can solve for yourself. It's only a problem that you can solve with and through your ecosystem. And the slightly oversimplified examples include supply chain security threats, like when SolarWinds was compromised, but also software supply chain security threats, like backdoors in applications. And that concept of interdependence is now being demonstrated to us through those specific threats. But the reality is that interdependence is an attribute of cyberspace. We are all connected to and through each other. The starting point then for a business would be to try and develop that view of their security ecosystem. Who do we depend on? Who depends on us? How do we contribute, not just share, but contribute to improving our security as an ecosystem collectively?
Now that intrigues me, because that brings us back to the question of guardians. You know, if I put my industry analyst hat on and go back 15, 20 years, I can remember having conversations with the likes of Hewlett-Packard and IBM and others about how larger organizations need to consider how they provide knowledge and technical expertise to people in their supply chain and their customers to help secure systems. So this is not a new concept. We haven't seen any real scale of instantiation of that as an idea, but it plays well into your comments earlier about guardians. So how do we encourage those large organizations to act, or not so much act, but at least to provide the guardianship knowledge to help the other people in their ecosystem?
Firstly, I agree with you. We're not having that discussion enough. Part of the problem is because the businesses and the organizations that are actually fighting cybercrime on the cold face are not the ones that are at the conferences or writing the articles or respectfully on your podcast. It's the likes of people like me who are being paid by a business that have got something to sell. And that's the first thing that we need to do, is we need to find ways to create forums for those kinds of thinkers to be heard and to interact with each other. The second thing is that we do actually see it. There are businesses that have evolved to the point that they understand the role that interdependence plays and appreciate the need to invest in their ecosystem as much as they benefit from it, and actually have quite well-developed, mature programs in place that describe that ecosystem and make targeted investments into that ecosystem. But the fundamental starting point is to talk about and remind people of this issue of interdependence, that you simply cannot solve the security problem for and by yourself. Once that penny drops, that's when the dynamic, I hope, will start to change.
I'd hoped we'd see more of it as people started to recognize that if I was going to attack somebody like Ford, I would not be going after Ford. I'd look much further down in their supply chain. We've seen with Toyota and Dentsu being attacked, part of its supply chain. I suspect when we see the breakout of that, that may even be somebody further downstream from Dentsu who was attacked and the attack filtered up. It's a topic that comes up again and again, this whole challenge of the supply chain attack. But often it's turned on its head. It tends to be the supply chain attack from the large flowing down to the small, not the other way up. Is there an easy way to reverse the way we approach the supply chain attack conversation?
I don't think there's an easy way. What I've been trying to do is to introduce and carpet bomb this interdependence concept. We've got a lovely term for it here in South Africa. They talk about Ubuntu. It means I'm well when you are well, and you are well when I am well. there's real power in it when we start to recognize that our safety and our well-being and the realization of a vision that we have for business and for the world come from our ability to understand and invest in that interdependence. It's not a weakness. Supply chains are described as a threat. You know, the supply chain is your threat, and we have to manage the threat, and typically as something we can sell you to mitigate that threat, and it's your responsibility to manage that threat. What I've been trying to say is interdependence, which is where the supply chain threat comes from, is not a bad thing. It's an attribute, leveraging and celebrating and working through interdependence. It's a sign of maturity. It's how individuals and communities develop. What encourages me, as I said earlier, is there are leaders and there are businesses who get that. They've survived through a lot. They're able to discern these nuances and respond to them. I just wish we could hear from them more. I just wish their voices were a little louder.
Oh, don't we all wish we heard a bit more from them? Charles, thank you for talking with me this morning.
Ian, it's such a pleasure. Thank you for letting me talk about things that no one else will listen to.